Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode we have my friend Hurley Haywood. Hurley's talking to us about 1977, 24 Hours of Le Mans, his first visit and his first win. Pretty incredible, a victory on his debut. Hurley would go on to win three times overall, his last coming actually in his last appearance. So not bad, a winner as a rookie, a winner again in 1994 on his exit, and also took one in 1983 as well. The first two as part of the Porsche factory team. And the third, we could say, definitely in the Porsche sphere. The last coming with a somewhat unique version of the Porsche 962, a road-going version that was built by Jochen Dauer. And whether you want to call that a full factory thing or not, let's just say that it definitely had deep roots. Regardless, the focus of our conversation here was 1977. Some wonderful stories from Hurley. Also get into some other ones about modern day, about drivers he interacts with and those who've driven some of the older cars. I think the Porsche 962 in particular, some funny anecdotes there. Also shares the two Porsches that he'd like to drive. Keep in mind, this is someone who's raced Porsche 917s and Can-Am, every GT car, every you name it, but he hasn't had a chance to sample the most current Porsche prototype. So for someone like Hurley, American racing legend, umpteen winner of the 24 Hours of Daytona and Sebring and a champion and just you name it, would love to see him tick those boxes. So come on, Porsche, let's make that happen. You get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast as they come out on iTunes. We also post those on our Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page. And with that said, off we go with the first of a couple of 24 Hour of Le Mans podcasts that'll be rolling out this week.
When I first saw that car, you kind of stop in your tracks and you look at it and you go, oh God, that thing is gorgeous looking. And it was, you know, it. When I'm asked today what my favorite Porsche race car is, I always say the 936.
Wow.
And I was privileged to drive that car in its three versions. So we started with the Martini car in 77, then in 80 we drove the version that was under Essex, and then the last was 81 where we drove it with the Jules.
Mm.
And the Jules livery was where we had the Porsche Indy engine in it, and that was phenomenal. That was the best of all the 936s. But for the 77 car, you know, that was my first trip to Le Mans. And when you, even if you're a racing fan and you just read about Le Mans and where it is and you watch movies, and you really don't have an idea of the physical presence of that racetrack and where it's located in the middle of an industrial city, which is a huge city. And I always kind of assumed that Le Mans was kind of this quaint little French town that happened to have a racetrack, but when I got there, I was like, oh, shit. So, you know, I'm sure you've heard that story a million times about, you know, driving around endlessly trying to find where the Porsche was encamped, and finally, in the middle of the night, I see this guy walking down the street with a Porsche jacket on, and I stopped and rolled down the window, and he looked in, and it was Klaus Bischoff, who was turned out to be my crew chief.
Yeah.
And you know, so it all went uphill from that point on. So it was really a cool car to drive. It was one of those, it's hard to describe what it was like to drive. It had terrific road holding. It didn't have ground effects, but it had, you know, good grip. And it had a very responsive, controllable engine, so you were able to kind of do kind of like the old school way of driving, like you would a GT car with your foot, but this, you know, incredibly stable platform that you were regulating. So it was really fun to drive. I loved driving that car. It was good in the wet. You know, visibility was good out of the car. And, of course, you know, originally I was teamed up with Jürgen Barth. So it was Jürgen Barth and myself and then Ix, and I can't remember who he was driving with. And their car went out, so they moved him over to my car, which is a huge advantage. Ix is, you know, the master of Le Mans. And, you know, I didn't have, when I got there, I mean, you know, I didn't have really a tutor that sort of, you know, this is what you need to do, this is what you need to look out for. Mm. I mean, I was like thrown in the deep end of the pool and say, okay, go fast, don't crash.
Nice.
So, but it all kind of worked out. It was a really cool experience. And that's, you know, when we didn't have the chicanes on the straightaway, and it was kind of old school, super fast. But the car was just so nice to drive that you really didn't think about, you know, the speed that you were traveling. I think back then, I think the average speed was like 165 miles an hour.
Yeah, just ridiculous. Well, I also love the fact, Hurley, that, you know, you describe the car, despite it looking very modern and swoopy and, you know, at this transition phase in the sport where prototypes were coming in as the vehicle for endurance racing, I love that you describe it as something that was still a physical car to drive, right? It wasn't just blind trust on a million pounds of downforce to get you around the corners or ridiculous power that made your lap time on the straightaways. It was still something that, you know, you were fully connected through your hands and your feet and your will to get the most out of the car instead of it feeling like, you know, something that did the work for you.
Yeah, those are perfect words to describe it. That's exactly right. You drove that car from the seat of your pants, and you felt every movement, and you corrected those inputs by the steering or by the throttle. And that's cool. You know, it's kind of like driving, it was kind of like driving a 911, really. I mean, a 911 would have had, you know, terrific road holding and great power. But the same kind of feel that you got, you could kind of toss around the corner and not having to worry about doing something unpleasant.
So it's a bit of an interesting year in that you had the Renault factory aiming for victory, and as we spoke before we started talking, you know, one of the key things to a great Le Mans and intrigue involves the top class and multiple manufacturers vying for victory. You obviously always want privateers in there as well, but you really do need at least two titans trying to beat up on each other to make a really compelling race. What do you recall, again, keeping in mind this is also your first Le Mans, so you're probably just, you know, drinking from the proverbial fire hose, but what do you remember of the anticipation or preparation going in, knowing that you had the home country, home team that were obviously trying to win their biggest national race, yet you're there trying to defend Porsche's honor as well?
Well, it was a huge honor on my part to be asked by the factory team to drive there. Joe Hoppen was the one that kind of crafted that whole scenario. Mm. I had really good luck with, you know, racing in the States in the 24-hour races. I had, I think, three or four Daytona wins under my belt. Three Daytona wins under my belt before I went over there. I had raced in the Can-Am series, so I was used to open cockpit cars. Yeah. But, you know, going to Le Mans for the first time is really a lot going on there, because one of the speed that you're traveling at, they have 55 entries that are, you know, in the race, and the top drivers in the world, and, you know, and we had the top drivers in the Porsche camp. I mean, Ix was like the master. And so they give me, you know, in practice and everything, I was, you know, doing a good job, and they were pleased with my time and everything was good. So they decided that they were going to give me the honor of starting the race.
Wow. No pressure.
No pressure. Everything's, you know, I remember I didn't sleep a wink the night prior to the race.
I bet.
Tossing and turning, going, you know, thinking of all the things that could go wrong. Well, I get down, you know, you come through the Dunlop Bridge, and then you went down a hill, and then you had a really fast set of S's that sets you up to go onto the Mulsanne Strait. And the throttle sticks wide open as I'm going into the first S.
Jesus.
So I said, shit. So I got, you know, the whole entire field, I think we started third in that race. So our sister car had the pole. We had a Renault, and then I was third. And so everybody's behind me. The throttle steps stuck open. I didn't want to put the clutch down. I had which was your first inclination is to put the clutch down. And if I did that, the motor would have blown up.
Yeah.
So I hit the kill switch. I'm trying to get over to the side to get over into the grass to slow it down, not hit anything. And by the time, you know, I get everything managed, I was going too slow to bump the car back into gear because I was going to go into a high gear and try to get it back. So the thing stalled. So I'm there, and I'm going, shit, what am I going to do now? The throttle stuck wide open. I can't restart the car. What am I going to do? So I had to get out. I had to take the rear bonnet off, which was, you know, a big get the thing off. So find out where the problem was. I saw exactly what it was. I'm radioing into the pits. And back then, you didn't have a radio like you do now. You had basically a microphone that you stuck up underneath your helmet, and you talked, so it was like a one-way conversation. Anyway, I got it fixed, I got it back, and I only had lost, I think, about a lap and a half by this whole scenario. So I get back, they fix it, send it back out. We, you know, we're like a lap and a half down. We're just kind of motoring around, doing everything we're supposed to. And then X's car, there's a failure in it, so they decide to move X over to my car to help us. And he was like brilliant in the night. I mean, he just was magnificent. It was raining, and he really did a good job. So Jürgen Barth and myself did what we were supposed to do, and X kind of did the majority of the work. And so then in the end, we had done such a great job that they were going to give me the privilege of taking a car across the finish line. So, again, no pressure. So I'm doing, everything is doing great. You know, I'm right on the lap time I'm supposed to be doing. And suddenly, in the seat of my pants, I kind of feel, ooh, something's going wrong. I look in the rearview mirror, and there is just smoke bellowing out of the side exhaust pipes. I said, oh, shit. So I slow down. I radio the pits. I'm coming slowly back to the pits. There is smoke, you know, coming out of the rear of the car like a fogging machine.
Wow.
I get back. They disconnect the spark plug, take the spark off the plug. They take the spark plug out. And then they decided that Barth was much more mechanically inclined than I was, so they decided to put him in the car for the last lap. So he's got a very strict time element. We're right on the 24-hour mark now, so like one lap. So he goes too fast on that one lap, and so they had to send him around another time. And so we're all in the pits, and literally, when he came across the finish line, the car blew up.
Wow.
Across the start finish line. And then so in the jubilation of finishing and winning, and I mean, it was just wild, I jump over the pit wall, which is a considerable height, and jump down onto the side panel of the car. And Ix is out there, and Jürgen, you know, is a pretty big guy, and my hand somehow got behind the seat, which was there was plenty of room, but he was, you know, banging back and forth. He was so excited that he basically, the seat came off the railing, and absolutely, I thought my hand was broken.
Broken engine, broken hand. This is a crazy celebration, brother.
I was able, you know, the emotion of the moment far outweighed the physical pain. So anyway, and then of course, you know, in the tradition of Porsche, you went, you know, you had to go to all the press conferences and all that kind of stuff. You had to go, you know, Martini was the sponsor, so you had to go to have a drink with them, then the Moët Chandon, the champagne, and then you had to go to dinner with the entire crew. So you had, you know, Professor Porsche there, you had, you know, all these, you know, high-ranking members of the Porsche family, Wolfgang, everybody, in this little restaurant that they had found that was able to take, you know, a dinner for 50. And it was like you were falling asleep in your suit, but it was, you know, it was a big deal. I had never in my experience in racing was enveloped in the whole emotion of that moment. Yeah. With so many people that had total access to you. I mean, if they wanted, you know, to leap on you and smother you, you wouldn't have had a choice. You couldn't have gotten away. I mean, it was just wall-to-wall people, and it was that was a bit overwhelming.
I mean, for your first trip to Le Mans, Hurley, to win, to soak in the huge adoration that comes with it, being a part of this massive Porsche machine with so much history behind it as well. I mean, of the many amazing things you've accomplished in your career, this one seems like, wow. You talk about lightning in a bottle, and just,
you know. It was good, but you know, it just goes to show you, you sort of pick the people that you want to dance with, and throughout my entire career, I've chosen Porsche as my dancing partner, and it's such a team effort. You just don't realize. I remember when Gene Lindemuth sent me over. I didn't have a ride back in the late 80s or 90s, at like 98 or 99, and I had elected not. I only wanted to drive in the prototype classes at Le Mans. I was not going to drive a GT car. So I had turned down a couple rides with the GT stuff. So she sent me over there to write a story for what it was like on the backside of racing, which was a true eye-opener and suddenly made you realize that there's so much that goes on behind the scenes that a driver never even thinks of.
Mm.
You know, when the driver, you know, gets out, he's always got his drink bottle there, he's got his food, he's got his doctor, he's got all these things to take care of him, but the systems that are in place to make that happen are enormous. Just the food alone to feed all of the people that are involved in the racing program is huge. You don't think about that when you're driving. You know, you assume that you're going to get what you want to eat, and everybody has a specific, you know, menu designed just for them, and it, you know, it's just a monumental thing. And so, you know, it's a true team sport, and even from the lowest guy on the totem pole to the top ranking driver, everybody is treated equal. And that's what made Porsche so great in those years, was the racing team was truly a family thing where we all helped each other do our jobs to the best of our ability.
You know, another thing that stands out to me, Hurley, is I'm assuming this must have been a bit surreal. So you've raced Sebring many times, Daytona many times at this point, coming in the 77 race, you know, great success in many vehicles, driven some wickedly fast vehicles. I'm curious what the experience was like with the 936 spooled up and raging down the Mulsan, and you come across a Porsche 911 or BMW 3-liter CSL, you know, tinkering along, doing its best. But it must have felt like you were flying a spaceship compared to folks riding a bicycle, just in terms of speed disparity and having to not only work traffic, but You know, there's a certain element of danger involved if folks aren't paying attention and moving around. What was it like getting there on that, infamously fast circuit, dealing with some cars that just were, seemingly stuck in first gear?
Well, that's kind of the same regardless of what car you're driving. And I've had the privilege of driving really fast prototypes and also driven GT cars with prototypes on the track at the same time. So it's just it's kind of a chess game where you're just working the traffic to benefit you and to stay out of the way of the fast guys. And when you're driving the fast cars, it's the same thing. You're driving a car that has an immense speed and cornering advantage over the GT cars, but still you have to live with those guys on the same track and you have to share the same asphalt. So there's always a sort of a give and take. I'll tell you, the 936, I really like driving open cockpit cars, and they, even though you've got an open cockpit car, the actual area that you're sitting in is basically pretty much calm from wind buffeting.
Yeah,
you don't get a lot of wind knocking your helmet around, and you just kind of, and I like the way that feels. You've got all this wind velocity going around you. If you stick your hand up, it'll pin it back to the back of the seat. But where you're sitting is basically pretty much free of turbulence. And there was always a good, the cars were comfortable to drive from a heat standpoint. It wasn't like a 936 or 962 where, the cockpit temperature was like an oven. So I liked it from that standpoint. Visibility was good. You always had visibility. Jackie X once, he showed me, he had this huge bubble shield on his open, back then we had open face helmets, and he had this big bubble shield, and I said, what do you, why is it so big? Why don't you just have a normal one? And he said, well, if I'm breathing hard, it doesn't fog the outside of it.
Hmm.
This is days of no fog and all that kind of stuff where you basically you use your spit to sort of, do that like you would in a mask there if you're going to use to go underwater. But, it was just a nice feeling. And it's one of the things that is so unique about Porsches, regardless of what Porsche you're driving. And this goes back to the early days of 911s. When you're sitting in a 911, all Porsches kind of feel the same way. You sort of get that feeling when you're sitting in a Porsche that it's home. You kind of know where the dials are. You know where the position of the steering wheel. When it's in your hands, it all feels the same to me. And regardless if you're driving a 911 or if you're driving a 962 or a 935 or 936 or whatever, so it's, and Porsche is one of the few manufacturers that have that sort of history that goes back so far, that and the evolution of that history.
You can feel the lineage, that there's something that carries forward, and you hear that from a lot of folks who, spent many years in Porsches, that wet roof, no roof, whatever model, engine, whatever, there is a Porsche-ness to what they're like to drive, and also, how they feel from the inside.
Yep, exactly.
Well, the last question I had is on a related but somewhat different topic. We're celebrating the 30th anniversary of the last Le Mans victory for the Porsche 956/962. You were obviously able to add another cool exclamation point in 94 with Jochen Dauer's version of the 962. But I'm just curious, as someone who's not only won at Le Mans in factory 956, But someone who, you know, was so heavily linked with that car and then, you know, added this cool final victory in 94. What comes to mind to think that, at least in, if we're talking factory-based victories, 1987, last win for, you know, probably the most iconic GTP slash Group C car ever made.
It's funny you should ask about that car, because when I look back at driving that car, it was very much, it had the same kind of feel that the 936 had. Hmm. You know, it didn't, when Norbert Singer, when we first started talking about this project, they basically entered that car as a GT car. So they took away the ground effects underneath the car. They made it a flat bottom, which was an engineering feat that Norbert Singer was able to work out on how he, you know, could do that and have the car still stay on the ground. And the end result, we went to the Paul Ricard to test, and it was just a lot of fun to drive that car. And it was, I think I set the track record at night with that car, and that held for a number of years. So it was really nice. It was, you know, Jochen Dauer was, and Vern Schuppen was the other guy that made those cars. Vern was a really close friend of mine, and we were selling his cars, his version, through the dealership in Jacksonville. And so, you know, I knew the car, but not as a racing car, just as a street car.
Yeah.
And I was really surprised at how nice that car was to drive. And you know, it didn't have that, you know, in a 962, you went through a corner and man, you were pumping. I mean, it was a physical exercise to get through the car, because it could get through the corner because there was so much downforce being generated by the ground effects, where the Dauer car was much lighter through the corner, so you didn't have to use kind of, you know, tremendous forces on the steering wheel, and you could kind of, it kind of open the car up where it was much looser feeling. And as I said, it was more like driving the 936 than the 92, which appealed to me. I like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And how about the 87 race, kind of closing the chapter on just, you know, if I could own one GTP car, granted there are a couple, I mean, I don't know if I could keep it to one, so that might actually be a lie, but I know that the go-to choice would be a 962, you know, even a 956, but just that model held such dominance over Le Mans, such dominance in IMSA. I look back at that 87 race, and you know, there's a little bit of wistful something. I wish the old girl was able to continue on, but you know, some Jaguars and Mercedes and a few other things came along to start winning. But is there any sense of appreciation, you know, looking back 30 years of that last Le Mans win, knowing that, you know, not only had you won in a 956 there, but you know, you were a key part in helping to develop this vehicle that made such great history in the 1980s in France.
Yeah, it doesn't you know, it doesn't seem like that long ago.
I know.
They're doing something over there for marking my 40th start with the 936 and in 77. And but in, you know, when you look at a 962, that car and the deviations of that car remain competitive on a worldwide basis, not just at Le Mans, but all over the world, for a 10-year stretch, which is pretty significant for a one-model type of car. And sure, we made lots of changes. We, you know, a little different engine configurations, a little bit different body work on the cars, but basically the chassis remained pretty much the same. And it's really cool to be able to experience that car. We have one in our collection, the A.J. Foyt car.
Mm.
And, you know, when I drive that car, and I let our current drivers drive that car, like Andrew Davis and Lee Keen, you know, they come out of the car after, you know, five laps at Daytona out of breath. They go, shit, I don't know how you guys did it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm exhausted. You know, and, you know, you forget how physically demanding those cars are. No power steering, you know, a shifter, like, you know, pushing a paddle through cement. I mean, it was a major deal to drive those cars. Now we got spoiled. We have, you know, power steering, sequential shifting. I mean, the physical, it's different from a physical standpoint, driving old cars versus new cars. I'm not trying to say that driving new cars are easier. It's just a different principle of what you're dealing with.
Well,
but it's very cool to be able to have that lineage to the 962, and basically that whole prototype starting with the 917-10.
Pretty amazing.
So that was 1973 to, you know, I haven't driven, you know, the only car I would really like, the two cars that Porsche has I would like to drive just for the standpoint of driving it, are one, the Spyder that raced in IMSA.
Yeah, the RS Spyder.
RS Spyder, and then the 919.
Well, I'm thinking Porsche needs to make that happen, brother. I know Derek Bell also was not too long ago saying how much he wanted to drive the 919. So it seems to me that Porsche almost needs to implement a new program for its legends who helped form the brand's history. Hey, guess what? You know, you need a little valet and chauffeur program here where the legends can come stay current with the new hot rods.
We won't drive it fast, but we just want to drive it.
Well, but I also think it'd be fun to have an exchange program where you go, okay, great, thanks, but guess what? Now I want to grab Timo Bernhard and maybe someone else, and we're going to go grab a 917-30 or a 10 or something, and you can get a feel for what it was like in my day, and, you know, we'll bring you a change of underwear and some tissues for your tears when you're done. So I think that'd be a fun...
Yeah, that would. Well, you can take that to Porsche folks to see what they say.
All right, I've got a new mission here.
And that was the great Hurley Haywood, 1977 Porsche Le Mans 936. Just what an amazing thing. Love hearing him describe its driving attributes, the fact that it was a little bit more of a GT style than we might have expected beforehand, but just knowing that using his right foot is actually a pretty cool way to get the car rotated and get it to work. Love to see him back in action in that. All right, well, this, as I mentioned in the beginning, is the first of a couple of Le Mans podcast features, so we'll have some more to roll out here, some retro stuff and also a little bit of modern stuff. All right, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. Thanks for listening.